Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 47 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. I'm your host, David Blakesley, and joining me today is Robert Taylor. Hello, Robert.
Good morning, David. Or hey, good afternoon, morning. Or good evening, or good early morning Taco Bell run, depending on when they are listening to this.
That's right. We operate a 24/7 operation around here. Whatever time of day, Criterion Reflections is here to fill your ears with some interesting movie chat. And we're kind of starting with kind of a no-frills intro, no music, no spoken word introduction from me. We're just plunging right into the conversation about a 1970 film by Barbara Loden titled Wanda. And you may be wondering, if you're a strict literalist adherent to the scheme here at Criterion Reflections, why I'm talking about a 1970 film when we are clearly in season 3, 1971. And I think I've got a good justifiable excuse for that. This was a film that did premiere in September of 1970 at the Venice Film Festival, won some awards, but it did get its very brief American run theatrically in the spring of 1971, March in particular, the same month of the year that we're recording this episode, as a matter of fact. And even though it was very well regarded critically by the New York film establishment and others who were kind of on Barbara Loden's wavelength, with some notable dissension as well, it's not a film that really created as big of an impact then as it seems to be doing right now. And so when I heard that Criterion was releasing this on their announcement slate a few months ago, I said, you know what, I'm just going to kind of bend the rules to suit my own interests and tastes and pleasures. And so we are talking about 1970s Wanda in the 1971 season. Yeah, so, you know, it's my show, my rules. That's how it rolls around here. But for listeners, you may also note that this is the second consecutive episode in which we're talking about a pretty new Criterion Collection release, which is quite unusual. It may never happen again because we kind of specialize in the back catalog side of things, given our chronological scheme. But as it so happens, both Luchino Visconti's Death in Venice, which came out in February, and Wanda, which has yet to be formally released to the public, but it's circulating now online through the kind of preview version of the Criterion channel. So we thought, well, let's go ahead and just record this and bump it up a little bit ahead of The Emigrants, which was announced at the end of episode 46 as our next, you know, next installment of this series. So with all those preliminaries out of the way, Robert, what'd you think of Wanda?
I love this movie. I love it so much. I love everything about it. I think it's a modern masterpiece. I'm unhappy that I have spent most of my life having not watched it. And you know a movie's got something when one of the greatest filmmakers of the 20th century decides to attempt to take credit for every aspect of the filmmaking from its filmmaker.
And we are talking, of course, Ilya Kazan, who just happened to be Barbara Loden's husband. And there's some very fascinating backstory to all of this. And we're going to be talking about the movie. We're going to be talking about Barbara. We're going to be talking about the whole context in which this film came into existence. But Robert, now make sure you're not just overcompensating for your dismissal of Death in Venice or any of the issues you had with that film this time around.
No, I promise that I am not. I absolutely was just gobsmacked by how much I love the movie. As soon as I finished the first viewing, I watched it again, and then I watched it again this morning before we recorded, and movies just don't get much better than this, do they?
Well, it's a really remarkable piece of work, I will say that. And the fact that it's lingered in a, well, not total obscurity. This film has had its adherence for, you know, almost as long as it's been released, but it was a very small insider crowd for such a long time. And I feel like this release by the Criterion Collection is going to vault this to a very high plane of praise and admiration, and only deepen the influence that it's already had on a lot of younger contemporary filmmakers.
It feels so singular. It feels like mm-hmm. you could ostensibly compare it to Cassavetes, I suppose, but this feels like a movie made by someone who has an incredibly distinct tremendous voice, who knew exactly what she needed to do and achieve that in spades. And that's one of the reasons I love it. You can notice from the first 5 minutes of the movie, this feels different than anything I have seen before.
Hmm. And that's pretty remarkable for, I think, for both of us. Yeah, got a drag race going on outside here. With
that motorcycle is running.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, but yeah, the vision and that singular voice that you've already expressed there really is a remarkable element here for a woman who had done some acting, had by her own admission, she had never aspired to filmmaking. She almost made this film, not exactly on a dare, but she was kind of spontaneously and quite unexpectedly given an opportunity, not a lot of money, but a significant amount of money to say, go ahead and make your movie and almost like show us what you got. And she did it. And she succeeded marvelously, almost perhaps too much in terms of the critical acclaim that this film generated, and perhaps the envious glare of her imperious husband staring over her shoulder, who probably had not gotten reviews quite of this caliber in quite a few years. But before I get into the backstory and the Barbara Loden and Ilya Kazan, let's just talk about the movie itself. We are in a very different milieu than, to say the very least, than what we just discussed in Death in Venice. You know, the opulence and the aristocracy and the history and the sumptuous beauty, even in its state of decay of the historic city of Venice, and all the privilege and the art and the intellectualism of Aschenbach's cultural milieu, whether he's a writer or a composer or whatever you want him to be, we're kind of at the other end of the planet here as we open the scene in the kind of gritty, gnarly coal fields of eastern Pennsylvania. Walk us through it, Robert. Why don't you give us this little sketch? What's the synopsis? How do you want to introduce listeners to this story? Maybe rekindle their impressions or tell them a little bit about what they've got ahead of them if they haven't watched it yet.
Well, Wanda is the type of woman who wears curlers to court for a custody battle that she could care less about.
Yeah, a custody surrender, really, is what it is.
Yeah, she shows up and she's just like, you can take them, I don't want to deal with this. Literally while the children are right there next to her. And she is a driftless type. We've seen many variations of this in the 1970s from the male perspective, but not so often from the female perspective. And despite the fact that she lives with her sister, she one day decides to pick up with a man who at first she just thinks he's a bartender, but it turns out that he was there to rob the bar. And then she just hangs around. When she realizes that he is in fact a thief, she doesn't seem much fazed, nor does she seem much fazed when they start driving across country together, Bonnie and Clyde style. But this sort of feels like an anti-Bonnie and Clyde in many mm-hmm. ways. Mm-hmm. He ultimately tries to enlist her in a bank robbery, and at first she seems to resist a bit, but then becomes part of it, and then the end happens, which I'm not going to spoil.
Okay, yeah, we can do spoiler-free. I think that's probably a wise approach. I mean, this disc has not even hit the shelves yet. Maybe towards the end of the episode we might get a little bit into the ending. It's probably a good idea to kind of wrap up that conversation. But let's just talk a little bit about this character of Wanda. She is a woman. She's probably in her, well, I know the age of Barbara Loden at the time was in her late 30s. She's still pretty attractive, but she's numbed out. She has been worn down, whether that's through physical or emotional abuse of some sort, or perhaps neglect, or there's just something that is just not clicking with her as far as her ability to connect with her husband, with her children, with this lot in life into which she has been born and has never really been able to escape. Something has happened there, and you know, I talked a little bit about the the positive reviews, but some of the critiques, but even by noted critics like Pauline Kael and others, who felt like we didn't get enough of her backstory. We don't understand her motivations. We need to have a better reason to be able to justify these, you know, what seem like extremely cold-hearted and callous decisions that she makes, you know, just walking away from her husband, leaving her children in the lurch, not standing up for herself. She seems like a very, well, it doesn't even seem, she is a very passive person who doesn't seem to have a lot of gumption or willingness to speak up and defend herself, articulate what she's looking for, push back when she's kind of getting the short end of the stick from cruel and cold-hearted and oppressive men. And yet there's something about her that you, or that me and many viewers, I think, find, boy, is it inspiring? Is that the right word? There's something that we connect with. There's something that we empathize with in this person's plight.
I think it's because the movie is just so intimate. Every single scene is just intimacy. Even when there are long shots, you feel as if you're getting such insight into what her life is like. So even though you don't necessarily sympathize with her as a character, there is such understanding for who this type of person is, which is why I think it's very smart that there was no backstory included about how she got to this point. She just needs to represent what she represents, and we pick up every single thing that we need to pick up from the way she behaves. My favorite moment in the movie is this tiny little moment, which I'd never seen anything like it on film before, where she has been tasked to buy Mr. Dennis, who is the name of the guy who picks her up and is the bank robber. She has been tasked to get him some hamburgers, and while she is gone, he has stolen her wallet, goes through the wallet, and throws it into the trash. She arrives back, and he yells at her because she allowed onions on the hamburgers. Oh, dear Lord. And so she goes to the trash to pull off the onions one at a time, sees the wallet in the trash, goes, "Hey, what's this doing here?" And then it's never mentioned again. She just pulls the onions off of the wallet, puts it in her pocket, and moves on. That tells you everything you need to know about the woman.
Very, very well said, and a great observation, because it is. It's one of these little throwaway character moments. It's not like everything stops and she focuses on the wallet and, ha-ha, this man is mistreating me. She takes it completely in stride, as if, yep, that's just what happens when I'm around men, with whoever the man in my life is, whether it's been my husband, old boyfriends, who knows if she's had affairs. You know, the observation's been made that she's the prettiest girl in a small town, and perhaps there's a certain baggage of reputation from her own, you know, earlier phases of life that has clouded her existence and her ability just to get that fresh air and that freedom that, you know, she in some way, some ambling, fumbling, inept way as she's striving towards, she just does not know how to get there. She doesn't, as Barbara Loden herself said about the character, she doesn't have the equipment, she doesn't have the tools to achieve what she maybe instinctively or intuitively knows would be best for her. She is relentlessly stuck in, you know, whether it's just passively enduring the indifference of the world to a person like her, or whether she's trying to take assertive action and saying, I'm going to step out, I'm going to walk out on this existence and do something different, only to find herself in escalatingly worse predicaments, you know, one after the other. And then the resolution of the movie is no resolution. It's a continuation, or perhaps stepping into a new existence. And again, we won't get spoilery right now, but we'll get to that. There are a lot of moments early in the film, even before the kind of the crime spree plot element enters into it that I think are really just very anthropologically fascinating, because this is primarily, of course, the story of a woman and her experience and her response to that experience. But there's this whole environment that's created. What stood out to you as far as just the little coal town in Pennsylvania where she comes from? Any moments or other kind of character, incidents that kind of caught your attention?
I think the first 5 to 7 minutes are just about as perfect a setting of a scene as one can get with the quiet and then the shot choice of, in the house, just the mess that surrounds her and the fact that we open on her face down on the couch. And we've seen mess in movies before, but how often is mess in films, in films when you see a messy house? It seems like a set designer has walked in and just thrown things everywhere with no real specificity. But the house that Wanda wakes up in, it seems like a legitimate mess. You know, when you let your house get a mess, there's curlers in very specific places where it seems as if the woman would take the curlers out and set them on the side of the couch and so on and so forth. I love that very real feeling specificity of where everything was placed, as simple and as odd as that sounds. And I also love the long take where we just see her wandering through the coal fields. It was coal, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's basically huge heaps of slag. She's clad in either white or light-colored clothing. The shot is quite distant. I mean, they're on top of another heap of slag, where the camera is mounted. And she's this little speck kind of moving across the screen. You don't even know where she's going, I guess, at the very beginning of the film. She wakes up. It's, kind of made clear that she's in her sister's house. The sister's husband, her brother-in-law, kind of storms out the door with a grimace on his face. And you kind of get the sense that she's a woman displaced, squawking babies. You can practically smell the urine from the diaper bucket wafting, into your senses there. And it turns out she's heading to court, and she's walking across this really very hostile landscape. I mean, this doesn't seem like even a healthy place to breathe the fumes that are rising from the ground, but that's the shortcut she takes to get to the bus line. She meets a slightly demented or mentally diminished old man who's picking through rocks looking for nuggets of coal that he presumably would take home to burn in his furnace. I mean, it's just...
And she takes money from him.
Yes, she asks him for a few bucks, is she contemplating that she's just going to, jump town and blow the coop and never be seen again? Probably. I don't know if she has an intention to pay him back, and he's obviously a man of very limited means, but she's desperate, and she's going to get what she can. So she gets on the bus, shows up in court late after her husband has already kind of, slagged her character, and you've already described the courtroom scene itself, where she just basically just lays it down. She just has to go through the formality, and before she meets the bank robber, she meets another guy who just offers to buy her a drink in a bar. Quick cut, the next scene, they're in bed, and you kind of can fill in the missing pieces yourself. But she's apparently sort of casting herself out on the waves, ready to just let them take her wherever soever the wind bloweth.
Yeah, and she continues this motif throughout the entire movie. It's just such a beautiful way to set up who the character is and the fact that we're not seeing a normal film where there is an active lead character. Everything about the character is, quote-unquote, passive. She's fine with the kids being taken away. She's fine with the man who she sleeps with literally running out of the room and getting to his car, despite the fact that they just had, an incredibly intimate act between them. It's so, I just keep saying intimate, but that's what it feels like. You, every single scene and sequence, you know this type of woman, right? Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up from, Dave? Where did you grow up, David?
Well, I grew up all over the country. I lived in Pennsylvania. I lived in Scranton, Pennsylvania in 1971. So after these scenes were filmed, but I lived in that actual part of the country the year after this film was released. I lived in Pittsburgh in 1970. I mean, I don't want to get too autobiographical here, but I basically moved every single year of my life as a kid for family reasons, and that's all here and there. But I know this area. I actually lived in the town of Clark Summit, if you really want to get into, Pennsylvania coal country lore. I was not a coal country kid. We lived in a little suburban housing development, but that's where I was. So I know the environment, and this film certainly kind of kindled some of that nostalgic recollection of the environment that I spent a year of my life in. And in 72, I moved back to Michigan, which is where I was originally from. So anyways, enough about that. So why do you ask about my upbringing?
Oh, because I grew up in Akron, Ohio, the rubber capital of the world. So it's not coal, sure. It's rubber. But you go to the store and you see women who are exactly like Wanda, who are walking through the store with the curlers and the hair. And the two kids who they could be less disinterested in. And then you see them pushing the cart, and there's like one little box of gummies for the kids, and then four bottles of vodka for mom. It feels so. And of course, Barbara Loden grew up in this sort of world, so she had a significant understanding of who this type of woman is. In fact, on the wonderful You Must Remember This podcast, Karina Longworth mentions that Loden once said, "Wanda would be me in a different world. Had I not gone to Hollywood, this probably would have been my story."
I think she actually went to New York because she was really much more accomplished as a stage actress.
Yes,
She did do some movies, so she's not a complete stranger to Hollywood, but she actually fled her North Carolina upbringing when she was like 17 years old, I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. Pretty young, and I guess this is probably the phase where we can start getting into the Barbara Loden story a bit. Her parents were both hardworking people. They worked out of town. They had been separated, and so she was basically raised by her grandparents in mountain sections of North Carolina. And by the time she was a teen, she was definitely ready to get out of there. And, by the kind of the providential grace of life, she was an attractive young woman with some ambition, with some talent, at least enough raw material to shape her into a personality and a visage, a photogenic presence that would allow her that escape route. And I do wonder, thinking about this story, if Wanda character had been played by someone who was not as maybe visually appealing or didn't have that same spark of intelligence behind her eyes and of course just the creative moxie to actually conceive and execute this project to the degree that she did, would we be as moved by this story? There are a lot of plain, homely, ordinary people who continue to live this life, but they just don't have that option that Barbara Loden did. Go ahead.
Oh, that's such a good point, David, because I keep watching her performance, and in many ways, it's not a quote-unquote good performance, because she doesn't do much. It's the character has to be sort of like a blank slate. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm like, this is a great performance. She gets exactly who the character is supposed to be. Great performances don't need to be flashy. They don't need to be big. They sometimes just need to be as interior as Loden is here. And you're entirely correct in that I think someone who, and this is an awful thing to say, but I think someone who would have been more, let's say, less attractive than Loden, it would be easier to look away and be like, well, I just want no part of this. However, because it is Loden, we will continue to look at her and just be fascinated with, you made a very good point with the, you can tell that there's something in her eyes, just something going on there.
Yeah. And so she had options. She had potentials, and she capitalized on that. She took advantage, and she took the risk. And it was, I'm sure, a huge risk. You know, obviously, showbiz stories are plentiful of the attractive people from small towns all over the world and all over the USA that went to the big city and got chewed up and spit out in the process. She did make something of herself, and she succeeded, although it was not necessarily an easy or comfortable life, and there were certainly compromises made along the way. And I really feel like that's where this becomes a more truly autobiographical story of Barbara Loden's own experience, not just the life that she may have led if she just stayed back there in rustic small town USA, a hillbilly country or whatever you want to call it, but in some metaphorical ways, this is almost like a parallel of her life in the glitzy, glamorous show business world of Manhattan and the Broadway theater and the whole, you know, entertainment industry that she was a small, but for a time, of significant player in. That she's, in a way, and this is you get into maybe the deeper analysis of the message that she's delivering, or at least the thoughts that she's stirring. She's saying, you know, the bright lights and big city of Broadway and Manhattan and L.A. and all of that, in its own way, isn't all that different than what you see happening in terms of the sleazy bars and bowling alleys and living rooms of rustic backcountry common folk.
Yes, exactly. And I also love that she basically went on the map for portraying not Marilyn Monroe, but Marilyn Monroe in Arthur Miller's play After the Fall.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in here, she could not be more scrubbed down. Her hair is as unkempt as it could possibly be. It's so interesting to think, oh, so she's most known for this. However, I cannot see her as Marilyn Monroe at all when I'm watching this movie. The range on this woman is shocking and beautiful.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think she's, in some ways, I don't want to say making amends, but she is balancing this persona that I'm sure was pretty, you know, for anybody who knew who Barbara Loden was in 1970, 71, her claim to fame was kind of this. Well, in fact, there's articles published in the mid '60s. Marilyn's ghost takes the stage. I mean, they were not very subtle about it. She was kind of the replicant, or the what's that word?
They were just saying she was Diet Marilyn, essentially.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And this was a play that Arthur Miller, who of course had been married to Marilyn Monroe, doppelganger, that's the word I was trying to think of. But Arthur Miller wrote a play, and this is after Marilyn had died, not too far after that, and Barbara Loden was cast to play this role. Her character's name was Maggie. Barbara Loden herself did a little mental gymnastics to separate the character of Maggie from Marilyn Monroe. There's some interview supplements on the disc that I've had a chance to watch. There, she talks a little bit about she didn't really want to be disrespectful to Marilyn Monroe, and she kind of created a little bit of a distance between herself, her portrayal, and the real person, Marilyn Monroe. I think, you know, inhabiting the persona of that frisky blonde bombshell creates a certain empathy for how she's regarded and, in a sense, consumed by the mass public audience, and the cost that that identity takes on a person who actually has to go through existence and live that out with both the benefits as well as the steep costs exerted by that level of attention. But she apparently must have been a very dynamic performer. Another quote from one of those supplements is that she was told by her husband Ilya Kazan. And of course, they had had a long affair, an adulterous affair, if you will. They were both married to other people for several years as they kind of kept this thing going. He told her that you don't have to give 100% of yourself each and every night out there on the stage, because apparently she just poured herself into it. And this was a role and a performance that required, a lot of physical exertion and emotional catharsis night after night after night. And she won a Tony Award for that. And so, you know, she was an award-winning toast of the town Broadway performer on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post in a very platinum blonde profile picture that is very reminiscent, again, of any number of Marilyn Monroe glamour shots. But boy, what a way to kind of achieve the top of the pyramid, you know, to spend so many hours, weeks, years even of your life kind of projecting that personality and being in that shadow when that may not be the entirety of who you really are, but that's how the public kind of almost demands you present yourself.
And then to be so at the top of the food chain and realizing there is absolutely nothing I can do, there is nowhere I can go but down from here, which is she got recast out of movies. Kazan only gave her a 2-line role in his next major Broadway play, and he tended to exploit her character for his own artistic ambitions when he would write about her in his semi-autobiographical but not semi-autobiographical novel. However, chose not to cast her in the role. And is this the part where I am allowed to start railing against Kazan?
I think so. Let me kind of get a few words in there, just maybe for some context. So yeah, as I've already said, the two of them, Barbara and Ilya, had an affair. I think she even fathered a child, his child, or father. She gave birth. He fathered her child. They gave birth to a child before they were married, and because this affair seemed to have some kind of legs or sticking power, I think he saw something in her character that, you know, fascinated and intrigued him. And, you know, maybe, yeah, you know, who knows? I certainly don't know Ilya Kazan well enough to know why he stuck with her when maybe he probably went through other relationships. In any case, they did make a commitment to each other. But she really, it seems to me, was pretty swiftly diminished and domesticated once that bargain had been reached, that he would marry her, she would live, you know, in kind of the, you know, the comfort and privilege that his fame and financial success created for both of them. But yeah, let's go ahead, tee off.
Well, first off, I want to say that I really like Kazan as a filmmaker. I think he's one of the greatest filmmaking voices of the 20th century, whose films like East of Eden and A Streetcar Named Desire are ones that I absolutely love. That said, this motherfucker, how dare he treat her the way that he treated her after her death? He ostensibly attempted to take everything, every bit of work that she did on this movie, take her voice away from her. The first thing that he said is, oh, she wanted me to direct it, but I decided that this was not the type of movie that I was going, that I could or would want to direct, so I said no. Then the very next movie that he makes is exactly in the style. He is ripping off Loden's style.
And this was just within months. Like I think he started filming in the fall of 1970, right after her project had finished, right?
Yeah, the film is called The Visitors, and I attempted to watch it on Turner Classic Movies about 2.5 years ago, and when I say attempted, I mean watched it for 10 minutes and then went, yikes, and decided to watch anything else instead. And not only that, but then in his autobiography, which was made after Loden's death, after she could no longer fight back, said, oh no, I made The Visitors before Wanda, so really she was ripping off me. Then he also said, by the way, I wrote the first draft of the screenplay. Then he took credit for introducing her to the cinematographer whose name escapes me.
Nicholas Proferis, I believe is his name.
Exactly, and working with him to create the visual aesthetic of the movie itself.
As if he would have insight into this type of character, right? I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean, the pomposity and arrogance and even cruelty of this man. I mean, who's certainly, you know, he has achieved enormous things and been recognized and lauded for it. But the fact that his wife, who is in effect telling a very intimate personal story based on her own experience, her own history, her own background, and he cannot even let her have that, not even in the shadow of her death as a lasting legacy. He has to swoop in and say, well, I'm really the genius behind all of that. It's just, it's infuriating.
Yeah, I mean, everything
why can't he just let it go?
Yeah. Everything good about Wanda was him, and everything that might have missed the mark was obviously Barbara. It's just, meanwhile, did not make every single one of our listeners turn off the podcast. But also, he had been using her for years. As I had said, he created a character who was obviously based on Barbara Loden for his book, that awful, awful The Arrangement, which I attempted to read. Can you tell that by the end of his career, I did not think that he was as good? Like, A Face in the Crowd, everything after that, including Splendor in the Grass, I have issues with. But that awful book, The Arrangement, he bases the character off of her, describes her to a T, and then in the movie version casts Faye Dunaway instead, because he just doesn't think that Barbara could work well with Kirk Douglas.
Well, and Faye Dunaway and Barbara Loden were not friends. They were adversaries. I mean, it was a very pointedly antagonistic relationship. So casting Faye Dunaway in a Barbara Loden role is really a middle finger in the face. It's spiteful. There's no other way around it. You know, it's again, it's cruel. I really, and this gets into some biographical material that I've encountered over the last week or so of kind of researching for this podcast. I don't know all the details. I know that she was, I think Faye Dunaway was Barbara Loden's understudy in After the Fall. So Barbara was out there on stage and she probably didn't miss too many performances. So Faye was just kind of part of the entourage, and Barbara made some very derogatory observations, let's say, of Faye Dunaway's behavior and priorities during that time. So she knew Faye Dunaway on a more personal level, not just as a professional actress who might have been a competitor or anything like that. And even the juxtaposition of this film with Bonnie and Clyde, you already made that allusion. But I think this was a very specific rebuttal to the glamorization of the, you know, young, beautiful crime spree, and the fact that Barbara herself knew that that's not really how life operates. You don't just roam around robbing banks and looking fabulous and you know, being model worthy in the process. It takes a toll, and the ending is in itself is not even a glamorous hail of bullets. It's just a shitty denouement of failure and corruption.
Yeah, are you okay, David?
Yes, my headphones just banged the microphone as I was turning my head, so.
I know, we're both so angry, we're so upset.
Seething over here.
And of course, in the misogynistic, awful period of the 1970s, people are going to listen to Kazan. Meanwhile, realistically,
he's the great man. He's the alpha male, definitely.
Precisely, and so I think that that's part of the reason why the movie was buried in the way that it was. It was, oh, look what she did, isn't she? I mean, it was mostly him, but good for her. Good for her.
And you even wonder if the distribution wasn't throttled a bit, because, like I say, you know, you can go back. In fact, the poster that I'm going to put in the show notes is full of glowing quotes. Let me just read a couple of them here. As moving as anything the cinema has discovered in years, London Times. I was astounded that something so fresh, good, and truthful was made at all. A remarkable film. Extraordinarily successful. A triumph. Wanda is so true it really hits you between the eyes. Had Barbara Loden worked for a lifetime in the cinema, this would have been a remarkable achievement. As a first film, it's a little short of miraculous. Honestly, if I project myself into Elia Kazan's shoes, pondering his egocentricity and even his masculine frailty and vanity, I bet he read that and it's like, this may not stand. You know, my wife is getting better reviews. And I'll just say it. I'm sure there was a genuineness of affection and warmth and care between Barbara and Elia, but there was also an aspect of her as a trophy wife. You know, she was that vivacious blonde bombshell, and he was 26 years older than her, you know, and she was a token, a bauble that he could display and say, not only am I a genius and I'm rich, but I got this sexy young thing hanging on my arm. I got it all, you know, and we see that stereotype, of course, replicating itself, you know, all through our culture, even up into the White House and all of that. But in any case, it seems to me that Kazan was not at all really willing to allow her to stand on her own merits. And I guess maybe I'm already beating that point to the pulp. But, you know, those reviews are pretty glowing. And you'd think this film really should have been given the exposure, but it really died mysteriously, kind of premature, you know, death in terms of its circulation and public impact.
And one more thing about Kazan before we stop attacking him, which he's dead, so yeah. I feel like we might be pulling a something that he did on Barbara Loden on him. But you also have to think that after America, he didn't make a movie for 5 or 6 years, and when he did, it was The Arrangement, which was historically a bomb, where everyone was like, well, he has lost it. He is no longer... He's basically making... I know that you like the movie, but they were comparing it to Valley of the Dolls.
Well, yeah. It's a critically deserving, you know, piece of work, so yeah.
But, and to see right after The Arrangement in place of all of this critical reviling, and it barely broke even at the box office, and now he's in Cold Country just babysitting Barbara Loden, their children, while his wife is making this movie and being hugely groundbreaking in the way that she is addressing the character, the camera, etc. You've got to think that a guy with that, who made Panic in the Streets and A Streetcar Named Desire in East of Eden, you've got to think that he's sitting there like, what the fuck am I doing here?
Well, okay, well, my last little coup de grace on Elia Kazan has to do with one of those supplements. It's a documentary called I Am Wanda, which is really a really wonderful bonus. Even people who have maybe admired this film for a long time, I advise that you get the disc just to get this 1 hour documentary, which is again available on the Criterion channel in its kind of preliminary form, although it'll only be here for a couple more days. But there's a very kind of quaint family scene where Ilya and Barbara and their children are sitting around the table kind of having a family poetry reading night, and it's really nice. And then when Elia's turn comes up to read, his choice is Rudyard Kipling's If. And I'm sorry, that corny old bullshit does not fly with me, you know? That's when I really said, okay, this guy, you know, he should be much more well-read. And he even self-consciously acknowledges that this is not a film that's, or a poem that's real popular with the modern critics. But it's like, you're really going to trot out that old chestnut? Give me a break. So, anyways.
That said, we both, I think, really admire him as a director when he's
I mean, I think, you know, he obviously had an incredible run of success and brilliance. I mean, you can't take that away from him. But it sadly kind of, I think, matured in kind of a presumptuous arrogance and a lack of a willingness to step away from center stage, even when his time had somewhat passed, and that's asking quite a bit of someone to sort of say, hey, you know what, you're not the hot shot you used to be. Just kind of gracefully, you know, recede from the scene. But you know, that's just a pretty common dilemma of humanity in general, is people who, you know, have their time in the spotlight and then just kind of grind on into redundancy. But when it becomes egocentric and manipulative, that's where it becomes a little bit more offensive and problematic.
And I think we're both also reacting so viscerally to this because this is the only movie that she ever made, and how many movies were we robbed from?
Yeah, and it's hard to say, right? but I mean, and really, whether or not it was the cultural output, because maybe she had more great movies in her. I know that there was a contemplated production of Kate Chopin's The Awakening, which would have been a fascinating project for her to take on, given what we know of her life experience and just her perspective. But even it's not so much that I'm mourning the lack of other film productions, although sure, it would have been great to see more of her work, but just the idea that she lived so much of her life kind of throttled and thwarted and under the thumb of men who would not really allow her voice to emerge without first running it through their filter, and in many cases perhaps just censoring her or shutting her down altogether. You get the sense that she learned some hard lessons in life. She pursued a certain path. She adopted that personality of the bubbly blonde, the dumb bimbo, whatever you want to call it, and it got her to a certain place, and then she recognized that there's kind of a certain emptiness to all of that. And she could have provided a lot more insight, but there seems to have been a certain amount of suffering and repression that she's had to endure. And I think that element and that recognition has created the common bond for a lot of people, not just women, although primarily, I mean, she's speaking to women's condition in this culture, and I don't think I want to overly generalize that. But I think a lot of people who have felt like, man, this world doesn't understand me, I don't have an outlet to say what I really want to share, you know, male, female, you're going to find something to connect with in this character's journey. And I think that's really, you know, the genius of this film. And so, boy, is it better to have that one unvarnished masterpiece that really sums it all up right there versus a long career where you've hit some peaks and valleys and you know kind of mediocrity in between. You know, it's a big question, I guess.
Yeah, it's the Charles Laughton Night of the Hunter thing. It's perfect movie for what it is, and you desperately want to know more about what he could have created, and yet the other ones could be a letdown. For example, she wanted to do a biographical movie of Barbara Payton. Can you imagine how great she could have been as Barbara Payton?
Well, I'll confess ignorance. I don't know who Barbara Payton is. Maybe it'll ring a bell, but tell me who.
She is this B-list actress from the 1940s who, you know what, it's a long story. I'm just going to tell you to Wikipedia after I'm over, let's just say, okay. French, there was a...
Is it Payton, P-A-Y-T-O-N, or P-E-Y-T-O-N? Like Payton Place?
P-A-Y-T-O-N. Okay. Let's just say there was a triangle with Franco Tone and Joan Crawford.
Now, those are some names I recognize.
Yes. Yeah, you're going... Unfortunately for Tone, but...
I'll throw a link in there for sure, yeah.
Yeah, let's just say it was a thing where she essentially had one of the defining moments of film noir in a film with Jimmy Cagney, and then by the end of it, she was a prostitute. So it's this incredible arc for her. And if you just Google what Barbara Payton looked like and then what Barbara Loden looked like, I feel like we're missing something that truly would have been great.
So, yeah, so she, you know, Barbara Loden did do some things in between Wanda and the end of her life, which very sadly was just a mere 10 years later. She died of breast cancer in 1980, I believe, and 48 years old. and was still doing creative work, still had ambitions for things, for projects that she was just not able to complete. And, you know, her medical condition worsened to the point where she had to drop out of things that she had immediately in front of her. And again, just a very poignant, heartbreaking story, and that's covered very, very powerfully by Karina Longworth in her podcast you've referenced. And there is a link in the show notes there, and in the biographical supplement feature on the disc. Do you get a chance to watch The Pioneer Experience by any chance?
I have not.
Okay, it's a half hour educational short film. I think it was made in 75 or 76, you know, so roughly a half decade after Wanda. There's not a whole lot of information, at least on the Criterion Channel site, that explains how this even came to be. And I don't know if she did more of these types of things, but it's a really, I would love to see more of this work if it exists. But it's basically her taking on the role of a pioneer wife. In this half-hour short film, she and her husband have migrated from the eastern USA, wherever, to a small homestead in Kansas, 160 acres, with a house that's already been built that certainly turns out to be less than what was advertised. But she and her husband, and I think there's three children, have to make a go of it out on the Kansas prairie in 1869, you know, a few years after the Civil War. And it is wide open spaces in the most horrifying, bleak, you know, gut-wrenching way. And it's just really just a half an hour of their existence making life for themselves in this very austere environment. And, you know, it's a little bit dramatized, but it's very compelling. And she gives another great performance, and it's about the life of a hard-pressed woman who is basically pinned down by her circumstances and just has to make the best of it that she can against really, you know, awful odds. And, you know, it's remarkable, but she produced and directed it. She did not write the screenplay in this one, but she's a pretty, you know, prominent performer in it. And it's a nice example of something else that she did. I believe she also continued to do theatrical work. That was a niche where she could kind of independently pursue her own vision. The problem with theater, of course, is that it's transient. It doesn't, you know, lend itself to reviewing later on. It's in the moment, and of course that's the power and the beauty of it. But for future generations, all we can do is read the reviews and wish we were there.
Yeah, there's that, and I'm breaking up, you must remember this again, there's that beautiful thing about she was in cancer treatments and needed to replace, I think it was Sandy Dennison, a play that she was producing, and she went on every single night. She didn't miss a performance, and then at the end of the night, Kazan had to help walk her up the 10 steps into their apartment because she was so exhausted from giving it her all that, it almost brought me to tears.
Yeah. I mean, just her dedication and the fact that she really was a quintessential artist, despite, you know, the apparent lack of preparation, if you will, in terms of formal education, training. I mean, she kind of came up through, the Copacabana, or she was a showgirl. I mean, you know, she really, you know, she used her physical attributes as her ticket into show business. And yet her legacy, her creative output was so far different than how people would typically assess a woman who, marketed herself, through those platforms.
Mm-hmm. And you also have to think, despite the fact that we have just given him shit for 15 minutes, it certainly was helpful that her first major play was Arthur Miller and Kazan.
Yeah, of course. I mean, without diminishing her achievement as a Tony Award winner, I mean, obviously she was placed in this ideal situation with all the prestige of names like, you know, Arthur Miller, Elia Kazan, the Marilyn Monroe homage, and really a culture that was grieving her, you know, Marilyn's premature death, and wanting to sort of relive that magic just one more time on the stage. I mean, it was the perfect formula for, you know, applause and awards and, you know, all the trappings that go with that. So,
and thank God that it happened, because now we have this, and I'm just going to call it a masterpiece. Now we have this masterpiece that we never would have had she not gone through what she went through.
Yeah. Well, let's just talk a little bit about that. I mean, I think this is the other thing. I mean, with this release right on the horizon here within the next week or so, it's about to blow up to a whole new level. I think there's a certain anticipation for people who haven't seen the film yet. This is a way of enshrining and sort of solidifying the following that Wanda, the film, has already produced. The show notes for this episode have links to books that have been written. There's some really great critical essays and even scholarship on what this film means. And I think putting it in a kind of a definitive Criterion Collection edition is really kind of just taking it to another level. And so what are some of your thoughts as far as Wanda's legacy? It seems to me that this is poised to really expand its impact and its cultural footprint as more people, you know, encounter what this film is. And I'll say, I'm a pretty recent convert myself. I watched it probably about a month ago. I had a kind of an early preview link to watch it, you know, right around the time or shortly after it was announced. And now, you know, the disc is about to come out. So it's going to, you know, kind of have that ripple effect. But how do you see Wanda's future as kind of a cultural institution is concerned?
I mean, I think its rediscovery is exactly at the right time. It's been 50 years of basically... It's 50 years, oh good lord, of being completely living in obscurity aside from a couple very, very smart film buffs who have attempted to put a spotlight on it, but it is hitting at the exact right moment in the zeitgeist when we are finally re-exploring female directors from previous years who never really got looked at the way that they should have before. However, I think it's going to be welcomed with open arms, and I genuinely think that within the next 10 years it's going to be recognized as one of the greatest independent films ever produced. I mean, I'm just going to say, I've only watched it 3 times in the past week and a half, but I rarely have such a visceral reaction to a movie where within the first 15 minutes I feel like I have dived into something and have fallen so completely and utterly in love with everything about the world, everything about the filmmaker, and everything about the style of filmmaking. And that's what happened here. It feels so rare, and I hope that other people get to experience through the Criterion release the same thing that happened to me.
All right, so yeah, so we've talked a little bit about the kind of, you know, the anticipated legacy, if you will. It's already, of course, got a pretty, you know, staunch following. Isabelle Huppert and many others, you know, have championed this film, and it seems very deserving of a Criterion release. I mean, there are so many other really cool moments that we have not even touched on. We've currently been kind of at a higher altitude level, which is, again, I suppose appropriate to remain somewhat spoiler free for those who maybe want to dig into the movie without having everything spelled out for them. But just some really fascinating moments. The little her kind of stepping into a kind of a migrant community, watching a movie in Spanish, that little weird Christian catacomb theme park. I mean, what is that stuff? It's just really kind of this fascinating cultural anthropology beyond just Wanda herself, but the other personalities and traditions that shape those communities. Go ahead.
I am obsessed with that theme park. I want to go see all of those, like, wax figures that are being eaten by the lions.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that we're speaking in generalities more than specificities, mm-hmm. because this is one of those very special movies where just describing the scenes does not at all give credit to how great the scenes are. It's just the air. Like, earlier when I was describing the scene where she's picking off the onions, mm-hmm. as I was saying it, I was like, this sounds fucking boring. But watching it on screen is just so engaging.
It's the genuineness. It's this very, and again, another allusion or connection that's been made to Italian neorealism, you know, bicycle thieves and other stories of the oppressed working classes struggling to make ends meet, you know, fathers trying to provide for their families and all the pathos that comes with the inability to, you know, kind of overcome the obstacles and the fundamental injustice that holds people back from realizing their full potential. This is a different type of situation. In fact, you know, Wanda's, you know, her alliance with this bank robber and his ridiculous grandiose scheme to not just, you know, steal some cash from the till. He wants to get into the vault of this massive bank right in the middle of a downtown Scranton, Pennsylvania. You know, Scranton's certainly not a Philly, it's not a Pittsburgh, but it's still a pretty good sized city with a police force to match. I mean, it's ridiculous the scheme that he cooks up, and of course it doesn't come to fruition. And it's her own ineptitude that preserves her from falling into the same dismal fate that her so-called lover achieves for himself.
You mean ineptitude of pulling an illegal U-turn in front of a cop?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, it's a brilliant little stroke because it's just another recognition of... on Barbara Loden's part to script that in to say it's this woman's clumsiness, it's her misfit characteristics that in a sense save her, even though they also limit and doom her to a certain, you know, strata of existence. It's probably worth also mentioning at the moment the inspiration for this story. Barbara Loden read a newspaper article around 1960, I believe it was, almost a decade or so before this film was created, in which she read an account of a woman who had been, in circumstances very similar to this film, kind of seduced or linked into a robbery scheme. And when she was brought to trial as an accomplice, she was sentenced to 20 years in prison, and she thanked the judge for the verdict. And, you know, that very strange response to a devastating legal punishment just grabbed Barbara's attention, and she pondered it for years before it ever turned into a screenplay. Why would a woman be grateful to being sentenced to 20 years in a penitentiary? Obviously, she saw that as an advancement, as an improved situation over whatever it was she was living through. And that really is another sort of nutshell summation of what this film is about. What would make prison for 20 years better than the life that you were living on the outs?
Which leads us, I think, to the most extraordinary moment in the film, which is a quiet moment, like every moment in the movie, really, where they have just gone to Woolworths and she is doing her nails and Mr. Dennis is confronting her about, like, what about your husband? What about your kids? Why are you out here? And she doesn't even look at him as she's doing her nails and starts laughing and she says, I guess I'm no good or I guess I'm bad. Mm-hmm. And, oh, what a wonderful scene. Just the way that she just throws it out there. You can tell that the character has thought about it. and not struggled with it, but made the decision that, well, I guess this is just how it is. This is who I am, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's resolved, right.
I'm laughing about it so I don't cry.
Yeah, and right, there's this kind of crust that's developed around her heart, her emotions. And it's a survival skill. It really is. Because if she were to make the defense and try to explain or apologize her case, he would not have any of it, and it would just sound dumb. She is who she is. She's made her decisions, and she's striding forward. Those are not decisions that are light, trivial, casual. They have real life consequences for her husband, for those children, for other loved ones and family members. But it's her way of saying, you know what, the role that you've cast me and the expectations you've laid upon me, they are not without consequence or price themselves. And I have taken it and absorbed it and internalized it for all these years, and now that's done. I'm not going to do it anymore. And it's a profoundly rebellious statement in its own quiet, meek, and again, very passive way.
I'm going to make an odd left turn. Do you have anything else to say about it?
No, I'll follow your lead, Robert.
Okay. This is just a tiny thing about the Criterion release. You've seen the cover of the release, right?
Yeah, it's a very significant moment towards the end of the film. It's just Wanda gazing over the shoulder of a cop as she's contemplating a situation unfolding in front of her.
That said, did you notice that Elton John apparently is making a cameo directly behind her?
What?
Okay. I assume it's this woman, but it is this... It looks exactly like Elton John in his most, like, flowery... He has, the person has neon-colored glasses. It's so odd that they chose that exact screen grab, because it looks like Elton John is looking over Wanda's shoulder. Are you Googling this so you can see it?
I am, right now. Oh.
Like, when they first announced the releases, I was like, they're going to change this, right? And then they haven't.
No, well...
And so for the rest of my life, I'm just going to assume that Elton John has a secret cameo in Wanda that none of us know about.
this is basically, what, 1970, 69, whenever this was filmed. Elton was still just a Reginald Dwight, you know, toiling in obscurity there. Well, I think Elton was desperate for whatever exposure he might be able to achieve, and so... a little two-bit walk-on extra role in the ultimate low-budget indie pioneer feminist film of the late 1960s. That's about as high as he dared to reach at the moment, but of course he went on to bigger and better things.
Anyway, sorry. I had to do that before we ended the episode because it has been bugging me.
Well, you got that little burr out from under your saddle there, so it's out there for the world to scrutinize and perhaps even respond to. Well, Robert, I've enjoyed this conversation. This is the first time that it's just been you and me since I think your premiere on this series with Midnight
Cowboy.
Yeah, so, but I always love the group panel conversations, but it's really been nice to have this one-on-one you and me kid experience here talking about a really remarkable, powerful, impactful film.
Thank you.
Yeah,
am I allowed to self-plug before we go?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you've been doing a pretty impressive series. You are staying right on top of Criterion 2019 releases. So tell us a little bit about what you got going on.
Yeah, well, last year, as anyone who listens to David's podcast regularly knows, my entire Criterion collection of Blu-rays and DVDs was destroyed in a flood, RIP. And so this year I have tasked myself to... buy every new major release by Criterion over the course of 2019, no matter what it is, and cover it in a blog. I was originally going to do upgrades and new releases, but then I saw that they were re-releasing Berlin Alexanderplatz, and I just can't. I sat through those. It was the longest 1900 hours of my life. So I will be doing most of the upgrades and all of the new releases as well, and it's been very, very fun so far. I will say this, people don't like it when you criticize anything about any Criterion movie, but the feedback I've gotten has mostly been a delight, and please check it out. I am very proud of the work I am doing, and if you enjoy Criterion, which if you were listening to a podcast called Criterion Reflections, you probably should, then enjoy.
Absolutely, Robert, and I second your... self-congratulatory opinion. You are doing fantastic work. Your write-ups are great. They're thorough. They're clever. All the things that you would expect from the Robert Taylor Odyssey. So I'm very happy to, you know, plug what you do and endorse it. I know for Death in Venice, you just kind of used our podcast discussion rather than a full formal written essay, which is great. But yeah, I've definitely been enjoying that. Did you participate in the flash sale recently?
I did. I got a lot of the Kurosawa films, because I did a Kurosawa Odyssey before I started this one.
Yeah, right.
They were all lost, so I rebought probably 17 Kurosawa films.
Oh my goodness. Wow. So you're kind of reconstructing the faded glories of old, huh? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I'm getting the essentials back, and then I got the Jacques Demy collection, because Umbrellas of Cherbourg... Yes. It's right up there with Modern Times as my favorite film, so how can you not have that in your collection?
Absolutely. No, it's good. And I'm glad to see that the at least the highlights of the old library are being restored bit by bit there. So, yeah, I just caught up with a lot of the new releases. So I've had a chance to watch some of them, and I just watched In the Heat of the Night last night. So a very, very cool film. I really enjoyed that one. Very thought-provoking for the times we're living in these days. Yeah.
Did you see The Sleep with Anger yet?
I have not. No, that's coming up very soon. I just thought, well, let's do The Heat of the Night. It was a cold night last night here in Michigan, so I thought, well, let's get some of that southern sunshine as well as other elements in the mix there. So we did. So, yeah, Robert, well, thanks again. I again, value your insights. Love the energy you bring to this. And listeners, let's continue the conversation. I do feel like there's a lot of thoughts and impressions and ideas that Wanda has stirred up, and very willing to continue the dialogue on our Facebook page, Criterion Reflections, the group. And let us know what you think when this disc hits the shelves and makes it into your home library, or even if you want to talk about the impressions that it made if you did happen to watch it through the less than mediocre Criterion Channel VHX application that's serving as our kind of, you know, umbilical cord until the full library hits us again later next month. We want to talk to you about it, so give us your thoughts and impressions. We'll take it from there. All right, next episode, as promised in episode 46, we will be talking about Jan Troell's The Emigrants, not The New Land. So yeah, we got that one. That was postponed a little bit. It created the perfect opening for Robert and I to get to talk about Wanda, and we'll be coming at you really soon with that. So keep listening and take care, and find your way across those coal fields and those barren wastelands of life, and let your voice be heard. Bye-bye,
thanks,
everybody.
David.
Thank you, Robert. Good night.